You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a scientist explains the potentially promising future of mRNA vaccines, which could someday be used to treat and prevent cancers, HIV, and autoimmune disorders. Now, the Winter Olympics begin this Friday in Beijing. Multiple countries, including the U.S., are taking part in a diplomatic boycott of the Beijing Games, citing China's human rights abuses. Some in the sports world have criticized the decision to hold the Olympics in Beijing in the first place. Here's longtime sports broadcaster Bob Costas.
The IOC deserves all of the disdain and disgust that comes their way for going back to China yet again. They were in Beijing in 2008. They go to Sochi in 2014. They're shameless about this stuff.
We're talking about political controversies surrounding the upcoming Beijing Olympics, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a fan of the Olympics, the sports themselves? Do you pay attention to the controversies surrounding the games? Does it bother you that the Winter Olympics are being held in China, which has a history of human rights abuses, including ongoing detention of Muslims? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Jules Boykoff is a professor and chair of politics and government at Pacific University. He's the author of four books about politics and the Olympics, most recently, No Olympians. Boykoff also played soccer for the U.S. men's national team. And at UW-Madison, he was born and raised in Madison and inducted into the Wisconsin Soccer Hall of Fame in 2019. Jules, welcome back to Wisconsin.
Hey, thanks a lot. Good to be with you.
Well, we just heard sportscaster Bob Costas, mainstream figure in the sports world, criticizing the International Olympic Committee. Before we get into the decision to have the games in China, can you talk about the role that the IOC, the committee, plays?
Sure. The International Olympic Committee is the Lausanne-based group in Switzerland that decides who will host the Olympic Games. And back in 2015, they voted to have Beijing host the Olympics, even though they knew at the time that Beijing was a massive human rights violator. You mentioned the atrocities that are happening in Xinjiang province against Uyghur Muslims and other Turkic Muslims. There's also the ongoing human rights violations against Tibetans, not to mention against Hong Kong democracy activists in recent years. And so that's exactly why Bob Costas commented that the International Olympic Committee is shameless, because they're the ones who knew all the while and yet decided to hand the Olympics to Beijing anyways.
You've written a lot about countries not necessarily wanting to host the Olympics anymore, and a lot of local opposition in places like Los Angeles and Tokyo and elsewhere. Is the IOC running out of places that are going to be willing hosts in the way that they want?
Well, actually, looking at how Beijing got the Olympics here that start on Friday is a good place to start, because there were numerous cities that were in the bidding for the 2015 winter, or in 2015 for these 2022 games, but they dropped out one after the other. This was during a time period between 2013 and 2018 when around a dozen different cities that were thinking about hosting the Olympics decided against it, either because they had a public referendum where everyday working people got to weigh in to decide whether they wanted to host the Olympics and they said no, or there was the threat of a referendum that people knew they would lose and so they decided to cancel their bid. Or in the case of Rome, there was a mayor who was elected, Virginia Raggi, on an anti-Olympics platform. So there's no question that the world is starting to understand that while the athletes are absolutely amazing and the Olympians are what they make the Olympics special, there's also a number of downsides that come along with hosting the Olympics, including overspending, including gentrification and forced displacement of local populations, including the militarization of public space in order to protect the Olympic spectacle, as well as greenwashing, talking a big environmental game but not following through. And for those reasons, numerous cities dropped out of the bidding, leaving only Beijing and Almaty, Kazakhstan, neither of them exactly bastions of democracy. In the end, the IOC went with Beijing, since that's the entity that they knew. They had previously hosted the 2008 Summer Games.
We have the U.S. and other countries having this diplomatic boycott of the Games. So still sending the athletic delegations, but not the diplomats who'd usually come in their wake. Do you see that as a meaningful protest?
Well, it's meaningful in the sense that they are trying to shine a spotlight on these human rights violations that we were just talking about. And so there's meaning definitely in that. There were some groups, including athlete groups, that were pushing for an athlete boycott of these Olympics, but the Biden administration chose not to do that. The goal overall of the Biden administration's diplomatic boycott is certainly to try to raise up the specter of sport washing. So sports washing is one of those terms that we're hearing more and more in the sports world. And that's when an unsavory regime uses a sports mega event like the Olympics or the Soccer World Cup, for example, to try to launder their reputation on the international stage, because these Olympic Games will come with plenty of grin and grip photo opportunities for leaders to look legitimate on the world stage. And so that's really why the Biden administration kind of made this move. They did not do a full athlete boycott, I think in part because of the sour taste that is still in a lot of people's mouths in the United States and elsewhere over the athlete boycotts of the Moscow Olympics in the 1980s, where numerous Olympians now have an asterisk after their names. And they've been quite vociferous about how that really hurt them in the long run. So Biden is not sending diplomats, but the athletes will be there in full force.
Talking to Jules Boykoff, professor and chair of politics and government at Pacific University, author of four books about politics and the Olympics, looking at the opening of the games coming up in China. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Jules, it seems like every time an Olympics comes along, there's sort of a yearning for the good old days when there wasn't all these politics in the Olympics. Did those good old days ever exist?
Well, hey, it's not just because I'm a political scientist that I'm going to say this, but no, from the very beginning, the Olympics have been political, all the way back to the 1890s, when a plucky baron from France, Baron Pierre de Coubertin, began the Olympics. He leaned on political plenipotentiaries, powerful people at that time, to create the Olympics in the first place. And the Olympics are to this day, through and through. I mean, this is one of the riding hypocrisies. The International Olympic Committee, which oversees the games, likes to say that it's apolitical and neutral, but that's just ridiculous. And in fact, their own actions contradict it. I mean, not even just 4 years ago, when Pyeongchang was hosting the Winter Olympics in 2018, the International Olympic Committee took credit for convincing political leaders from North and South Korea to create a unified hockey team to compete under one flag at those very Olympics. And so there's just numerous examples of the International Olympic Committee engaging in politics. Think about it this way. If the Olympics weren't political, then they probably wouldn't have them marching in by country, thereby stoking political nationalism. I mean, they could have all the bobsledders from around the world come in together at the opening ceremonies. But instead, the very way that the Olympics are organized actually encourage us to think about politics. Now, for me, that's not a bad thing. I think we just need to acknowledge reality that the Olympics are political and treat it as such. And just the fact that the International Olympic Committee clings to this ridiculous idea that the Olympics aren't political says a whole lot more about the organization than it does the politics that surround us.
You appreciate the athletes. You're an athlete yourself. Is there a better way to do this? Could the Olympics be reinvented or replaced with something that, I don't know, wouldn't lead to all these questions of corruption and supporting human rights abusers around the world?
There's no question about it that the Olympics could be done in a much better way that benefit the actual athletes, not to mention the host cities that put out a lot of money to host these Olympic Games. Let me just say one important study that came out recently that I think will provide some important context for us. Olympians don't actually make very much money from the Olympic Games. There was this study that compared Olympic athletes to other athletes from sports leagues like the National Basketball Association or the National Hockey League or the English Premier League of soccer or football. And they found that in those other leagues, athletes who participate in them get between 45 and 60% of the revenues from those leagues. In the Olympics, it's only 4.1% of the revenues. That's that goes into the pockets of Olympic athletes. And that's indirectly, directly only 0.5% of the money that flows through the Olympic system goes into the pockets of these amazing and hardworking athletes. So yes, absolutely, these games could be reorganized for starters to try to reward the people that actually make the Olympics what they are. And maybe to think about getting rid of this group, the International Olympic Committee, which has handed over the Olympics, not just to Beijing recently, but also to Sochi, Russia, where they had anti-LGBTQ laws in place ahead of the Olympics that very much clashed with the spirit in the Olympic Charter itself. So yes, there's much to be done on the reform front when it comes to the Olympic Games.
You have concern even when the games aren't held in a place like China or in Russia, even in the U.S. and Japan. You see a lot of negative outcomes there, too. What kind of things do you worry, even if we had one in Chicago and could drive down from Wisconsin?
You know, this is such a key point, and I'm really glad that you mentioned it, because a key point that's often lost in criticism of the International Olympic Committee's tolerance of tyranny is that by hosting the Olympics, democracies actually become more authoritarian. The historical record is absolutely clear that staging the Olympics in places like Beijing and Sochi don't help the cause of democracy and human rights, but neither does hosting the Games in Los Angeles or Paris, the two upcoming Summer Olympics. I just wrote this book on what's happening in Los Angeles, and a lot of people lean on the myths around the 1984 Games there, which a lot of folks consider to be a success simply because they didn't hemorrhage money like all these other Olympics do, hemorrhage public money. But reality is a little bit different when you start talking to people in Los Angeles about their feelings around the Games. It's very racialized, the remembrances of those Olympic Games. In other words, if you're an affluent white person from Los Angeles, you're probably going to have positive memories about the 1984 Games, and you're probably going to support the 2028 upcoming Summer Games. But the people who are African-American, Latinx, who I spoke with in Los Angeles had very different memories of those 1984 Games. Their communities were intensely policed during the Olympics, and a lot of the special weapons that were purchased for the Olympic policing then went to the Los Angeles Police Department, and they turned around and used them on those very racialized communities. So it's a mixed bag for sure, these Olympic Games in Western democracies. In fact, there's some serious endemic downsides that I mentioned before, and more people are becoming aware of this, and that's why fewer and fewer cities are game to host the Olympic Games.
We're talking to Jules Boykoff, author of No Olympians and three other books on the politics of the Olympics. Now with Pacific University, you can join in at 800-642-1234 as we talk about the politics of the Olympics in anticipation of the Winter Games kicking off officially in Beijing this Friday. Are you going to watch? Do you think it was a mistake to award the Games to China? Where would you like to see them held? Do you want to see them held in a city near you? Do you worry about the impact of these games in supporting governments like China's? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with former Olympian and author of four books on the Olympics, Jules Boykoff. We're talking about the Beijing Olympics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are these Olympics on your mind? Are you planning to watch? Do you worry about the overlap between politics and the Olympics? Do you dislike the decision to have the games in China, that decision by the International Olympic Committee? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Matt emailed, unbelievable that we're even having this discussion. There is ongoing genocide going on in China. Unreal, we've become so detached from the realities today that instead of widespread condemnation, we have thoughtless ignorance. Thanks for sending that in, Matt. Jules, when it comes to the media and how the media covers these Olympics, are you hoping that can shine a light on what Matt sees as thoughtless ignorance?
There are a lot of people that share Matt's sentiments when it comes to these Olympic Games, and it's going to be really interesting to see how NBC negotiates the situation. As your listeners will know, NBC broadcasts the Olympics in the United States, and they fancy themselves as a news organization. And if you're a news organization, one might think you'd want to provide the wider political and historical context around these Olympic Games, including those atrocities that Matt mentioned there. And we'll have to see if they do that. They have said that they might do that. But, you know, the corporate sponsors of the Olympic Games that fork over millions of dollars to become corporate sponsors, they've been conspicuously silent in this moment. They have not spoken out, even though pretty much every one of them has human rights provisions built into the way they do business. And yet they've been totally quiet. They're not having campaigns in the United States. Coca-Cola, for example, a big Olympic sponsor, is only doing their campaign in China. And they're basically having a low profile here in the United States. And so, yes, I think he's raising really important points that need to be considered here. Hopefully NBC will actually consider them.
Matt, thanks for emailing in. You wrote in a recent piece, I think it was in the Guardian, Jules, about the China Olympics. you are also concerned that there might be sort of a performative saber rattling going on, an escalation of tensions between the U.S. and China that you also worry won't be that productive as it relates to the Olympics. What do you worry about?
No question about it. The Beijing Olympics are about a lot more than just the Olympics. And that U.S. diplomatic boycott that you and I were talking about moments ago is arriving amid escalating tensions between China and the United States. In the United States here, we have politicians on both sides of the political aisle that say all manner of things about China. And this feeds, I think, oversimple narratives that tend to contrast a freedom-loving USA against some kind of diabolical Chinese state when reality is much more complicated. And actually, China's come back at the United States and said things like, oh, you're really one to talk about human rights. I mean, look at the fact that you have kids in cages. Look at the fact that you have these military bases encircling the world, some 750 military bases, and not to mention the unquestioning support for Israel, a country that Human Rights Watch recently described as carrying out crimes against humanity of apartheid and persecution against Palestinians. You know, I live on the West Coast where homelessness is basically a humanitarian crisis in plain sight. And so when Biden waggles a finger at China, there's been actually quite a bit of pushback, not just from China, but from other countries that view it as hypocritical as well. And it's been really interesting to see, Rob, how few countries have actually jumped on to this boycott that the Biden administration is leading on the diplomatic front. Just a handful of allies like Canada, Australia, Britain. But really, most other countries are kind of trying to stay away from it. They understand China's rising power in the geopolitical system. And also the fact that the United States, you know, we have our problems with democracy here in the United States. Look at the polls that are coming out day in and day out. People in our country are extraordinarily concerned about the direction of democracy. And so the Beijing Olympics arrive at this really key time of tiresome and tired relations between China and the United States.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Jeremy is with us in Racine. Jeremy, hi.
Hi. I'm not a really big fan of China. Never really was. But I've never heard of any genocide that they're conducting. So I'm not exactly sure where that came from. If you can elaborate on any genocide act that they're conducting. I know they have internment camps. Can you elaborate more on that? Mostly, I believe the reason why we're doing this, they're using human rights as a launching pad, but there's a lot of geopolitical actors are going on right now in Southeast Asia with Australia, Japan, the Philippines. So China is exerting itself out there and it's starting to put pressure on those allies of ours. So that's probably more of what's really going on in regards to the boycott than genocide. I never heard anything about genocide.
Jeremy, thanks for the call. Jules, I know there's arguments about what constitutes genocide. Whatever's going on is pretty bad, though, when it comes to the Uyghurs and other Muslim groups in the area.
Yeah, I mean, China has been accused by the United States of committing genocide. The State Department has said that's what's going on. If you talk to groups like Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International, who are monitoring mega events like the Olympics and the World Cup of soccer, they will tell you that there are crimes against humanity that are happening in China against the Muslim minority groups in Xinjiang province, for example. And so the crimes against humanity term, which is rooted in the International Criminal Court Rome Statute, it's an actual analytical and legal term. That is what usually you hear. And it's interesting to hear the comments about the possibility of genocide, because on one hand, people use the term because they're really trying to raise the stakes and show how important it is. On the other hand, it can really turn people's minds off because they hear about genocide and they wonder if it's actually merited. The fact of the matter is people are being massively mistreated in Xinjiang province, living in basically high-tech surveillance bubbles, not to mention being detained for long periods of time and having to succumb to torture and other awful things that happen to people. So however you slice it and dice it, it's not pretty. And what you're seeing as we speak right now definitely clashes with the spirit of the Olympic Charter that lifts up ideas about human dignity and even mentions human rights at one point in the charter as well.
Thanks for the call, Jeremy. Jeremy also sees this maybe as, he says, human rights is a fig leaf to cover what's actually international power confrontation here between the U.S. and its allies and China.
And I think that's a totally fair point that Jeremy is raising there, because the games are about much more than just the Olympic Games. There's an ongoing power battle that's happening as we speak. China has rolled out this Belt and Road Initiative that some of your listeners might have been hearing about in the news, which basically is a way of helping countries around the world develop. There's been a lot of media coverage of how they've done this in sub-Saharan Africa, but they're also doing it, China is, in places like Italy and Greece and Turkey, supplying money and funding for these countries to develop their ports, their railways, and so on. And with that has come a lot of goodwill. I mean, prior to that, it was their options in these various countries were often the World Bank and the IMF, as led by the United States. And they really weren't working, actually. And so a lot of people were disgruntled with that and perfectly happy to have another option. China's providing another option for the world right now. And I think we do well to view these Olympics through that wider lens.
In our last couple of minutes, Jules, are you were an athlete. Are you able to watch an Olympic sport and still enjoy it, knowing everything that's going on behind the curtains there?
You know, I do still cheer for certain athletes who are participating in the Olympics. I was not an Olympian myself. I did not participate in the actual Olympics, although I had the good fortune, as you mentioned, of playing for the U.S. national team, the under 23 team. And so I do know a little something about committing your life to high level sport. I will cheer on some athletes. I'm lucky that a lot of athletes reach out to me after maybe they read something that I wrote and want to talk behind the scenes. And I've done interviews with athletes and included their words in my essays that I write, for sure, including a couple that are coming out later this week. So I think that athletes deserve our respect and they deserve our consideration during these Olympics. We need not devote ourselves to the death of complexity. We can both cheer on these amazing Olympians and at the same time level serious critiques against the Olympic machine, because the Olympic machine definitely deserves some critical thinking around it.
Jules, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Jules Boykoff is a professor and chair of politics and government at Pacific University. He's the author of four books about politics and the Olympics, most recently, No Olympians. We looked at controversy surrounding the upcoming Winter Olympics in Beijing. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, a lot of people have switched their career paths over the last couple of years, and maybe you're thinking about doing it too. Get some advice on switching gears in your careers. Call in with your questions or maybe share your own experience if you made a big jump. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Have you played this Wordle game? I haven't, not yet anyway, but it came out of nowhere late last year, and now it has millions of people apparently playing it every day trying to figure out a five-letter word. This week, the New York Times bought it from the developer for an amount reportedly in the low seven figures. Wordle isn't the first word and puzzle game out there, of course, and we're going to talk about those games and puzzles tomorrow here on the show. And we want to hear from you now on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Have you joined the Wordle craze? Or are you tired of seeing people post their results on social media? Are you a fan of crosswords, jumbles, word apps, or how about in-person games like Scrabble and Boggle? Or maybe numbers? Did you get into a Sudoku and its spin-offs? Share your story. Let us know over on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@wpr.org. Searching for your words, this is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, thousands of deer and other wild animals die on Wisconsin roads each year. We'll hear how specially designed overpasses can help keep animals and drivers safer. Now, the world's first ever FDA-approved mRNA vaccine came out last year, the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine. Our next guest has been studying mRNA and other gene-based vaccines for decades. She says the possibilities of these kinds of vaccines are enormous, with the potential to treat HIV, autoimmune disorders, and some kinds of cancer. Deborah Fuller is a professor of microbiology and the division chief of infectious diseases and translational medicine at the National Primate Research Center at the University of Washington. Deb, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it seems like mRNA technology for a lot of us was new with these COVID vaccines, but you and others have been researching this technology for a long time. Can you tell us about the research that may have been under the radar for most of us?
Yeah, research started over 30 years ago. Actually, a lot of research in mRNA vaccine technology started right at the University of Wisconsin there. So I actually lived in Wisconsin for almost 20 years and did a lot of my initial research there. But a lot of it got started many years ago just with the idea that if you could get a genetic material into our cells, RNA in particular, and instruct our cells to make proteins, that those proteins could lead to induction of immune responses against those proteins. So that was sort of the concept of vaccines, but at the same time, we had always been thinking about them for other uses, like for gene therapy or for cancer immunotherapy. And so all this work has been going on for a period of about 30 years, even before SARS-CoV-2 hit us.
Talk a little bit more about how the mRNA works in the vaccine setting, if you would, before we get into some of these other treatments that are maybe in the works.
Absolutely. So mRNA actually codes for protein, and that protein would be, in this case, a protein from the virus itself. In this case, for SARS-CoV-2, it was a spike protein. And so the way RNA vaccines work is that you inject that genetic material into the body, it gets carried into the cells, and then it instructs the cells to start producing that protein. So it's like your own body becomes your own vaccine producer. So your cells are producing the vaccine antigen, and then once that's produced, your immune system can see that and start generating antibodies against that protein. Once those antibodies are made, those are going to be circulating in your blood and be able to protect you should you get exposed to SARS-CoV-2. So that's with SARS-CoV-2, but we've been working on that for many other infectious diseases even before the pandemic struck, like, for example, for HIV and for influenza, because we thought the next pandemic was actually going to be flu, and it turned out to be coronavirus. One of the beautiful things about RNA vaccines and very closely related DNA vaccines is that they can very quickly be pivoted to address really any infectious disease. So while we were working on HIV and influenza, when the pandemic struck, it was very easy for us, once they knew the sequence of the spike protein, to simply replace out the sequences for HIV or influenza and insert them into our RNA platform and then be able to inject that into people. And voila, you have a COVID-19 vaccine.
And Deb, with HIV in particular, my understanding is it is a virus that's a very hard target for vaccinations. People have been working on this for a long time. Where are we now? What kind of promise does mRNA have for an HIV vaccine?
There's a huge amount of promise. So as you mentioned, HIV is a big, big challenge. In many respects, SARS-CoV-2 was a low bar compared to HIV, which is a very, very high bar, not only because of its level of diversity, but because when that virus gets in your body, it goes latent. It can sit in your cells for a long period of time and hide from the immune system. So that has created a lot of challenges for researchers to develop an HIV vaccine. Now, recently, Moderna has started a phase 1 human clinical trial of a very promising HIV vaccine that is built on this idea that what you would do is expose the body to different antigens that represent different HIV variants and allow the body to develop these broad neutralizing antibodies that could potentially protect you against any HIV variant that comes along. Now, they just started that trial, and prior to mRNA vaccines, that would be somewhat of a complicated vaccine, because what it requires is that you basically boost people with very different vaccines, somewhat differently modified vaccines, to develop their immunity. But if you're going to make a protein-based vaccine or traditional vaccine representing each one of those, that becomes almost logistically a nightmare to do. But with mRNA vaccines, because they're so simple to update and to change, you can very readily be able to immunize people with this sort of series of different exposures to different HIV antigens to induce that response. So we're very optimistic that this might be really a promising approach for HIV vaccines.
Talking to Deborah Fuller, microbiology professor, formerly here in Wisconsin, now at the University of Washington, talking about the prospects for vaccines and treatments using mRNA technology. You mentioned cancer earlier, and correct me if I'm wrong. If I understand it correctly, this wouldn't be a cancer vaccine necessarily, but a way to use mRNA to help treat people who have cancer already. Do I have that right?
Yeah, well, it's both, actually. Let's talk about the treatment first. Because that's really what's in clinical trials right now and has been actually even before the COVID-19 vaccines. There were already mRNA vaccines being tested in humans for treatment of cancer. So what happens in cancer is that we get these aberrant cells that become, look like they're going to be cancerous. And normally what happens is that when a cell kind of changes and becomes more tumor-like, our body recognizes that as not being normal and will eliminate that. That's what happens in a normal situation. What happens when we get cancer is that our immune system doesn't quite recognize that altered cell, and that cell then is allowed to grow into a tumor. So what mRNA vaccines are trying to do is actually stimulate in a person who already has cancer that immune response that's in our body that's capable of finding those tumor cells and eliminating them from our bodies. So how does it do that? When a cell becomes cancerous, it starts to produce these sort of new antigens. They're different from normal antigens. We call them neoantigens. And when those are produced, we can actually pull out the cells from somebody who might have cancer and actually sequence what is that neoantigen, what is it producing. And once we've identified that, that can be inserted into an mRNA vaccine, injected into that person, and then that person will better be able to make immune responses against that neoantigen, which is presented on the cancer cell. Once you have immune responses against a neoantigen, your body will see that tumor cell much more efficiently and hopefully be able to eliminate it more effectively.
I wanted to take a minute to talk about autoimmune disorders. I think for a lot of people, a very frustrating condition that doesn't seem like there's lots of treatments for. Can you take a minute to talk about what mRNA could do?
Yeah, it's sort of almost an opposite thinking in a way. We've been talking all along here about cancers and infectious diseases that we're always trying to use the mRNA vaccines to stimulate and activate an immune response to eliminate an infection or eliminate a cancer cell. In autoimmunity, we want the opposite effect, because autoimmunity is like an overactive immune response against our own self proteins. We're attacking ourselves with our immune system, basically. And so what an mRNA vaccine that is structured as more of an autoimmune sort of to suppress autoimmunity is that we alter some of the sequences in such a way that instead of stimulating and activating an immune response, we activate other types of immune cells in our body. They're called regulatory immune cells, and they function to dampen our immune system. And so if we can activate those to specifically target immune cells that are attacking our own cells, our own proteins, then we can actually dampen the immunity and suppress the autoimmune reactions in our body.
Well, Deb, we'll leave it there. Thanks for taking us on a tour of this technology.
Yeah, my pleasure.
That's Deborah Fuller, professor of microbiology and division chief of infectious diseases and translational medicine at the National Primate Research Center at the University of Washington. She talked to us today about the future potential of mRNA vaccines and treatments. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary Kate McCoy with a story about a chance encounter with a squirrel.
When writer Ron Weber decided to go for a walk on a pleasant January day, he encountered an unexpected companion. Their shared journey was both amusing and inspiring, offering Weber a thoughtful reflection on the importance of play.
I opened my jacket as I walked, odd for midwinter, but the warmth of a January thaw was welcome. I decided to grab a quick snack as it was pushing noon. Munching on mixed nuts, I caught a glimpse of movement up ahead. A gray squirrel, a portly fellow who looked as though he had taken his task of fattening up for winter seriously, entered stage left. He rummaged through the softening snow until he reached a large basswood and promptly scurried into the treetop. My eyes followed him from one branch to the next, passing into a neighboring ash. By the next tree, I had joined the squirrel on his journey. I scanned the branches ahead, trying to anticipate our next move. Though a few times I got it right, my guide often had other ideas. I trusted his judgment on such things, so on we went. The fifth treetop looked like the end of the line. There was a 2-foot gap to cross to reach the next tree. That appeared to be the least of our problems. The closest branches on each tree looked like they would have a hard time supporting a chickadee, much less a 2-pound squirrel. It was a fun ride while it lasted. I imagine in squirrel school, pupils learn that traveling in the treetops is safer than on the ground, where predators await from there and above. The curriculum, I would hope, must also cover the physics and limitations of treetop travel. Much to my surprise, or shall I say horror, he started shimmying out onto the branch. He laid out flat like someone trying to get off thin ice and began inching forward. Then, much to my delight, with the flick of his tail, he backed up and got onto a thicker part of the branch. I thought he had finally come to his senses, but in a flash, he simply dropped down to a lower part of the same branch and again crawled out toward the end. I knew then he had no intention of backing away from this challenge. He was going to jump. Sir Isaac Newton clearly stated in his third law of motion that for every action force, there is an equal and opposite reaction force. I had seen this demonstrated many times, most applicable to this situation, by a friend who tried to jump from our boat onto the dock. But as he pushed off the boat moved further away from the dock, and he came up short and in the drink. I was hoping my newfound friend hadn't slept through science class and mislearning this important tenet of science from the headmaster squirrel. In an instant, he was in midair. He sailed across the chasm, grabbing the thin branch of the next tree. The branch swung down, and like Tarzan on a vine, he rode the branch forward, letting go at the perfect time, his momentum carrying him to a sturdy part of the branch. A human pulling off such a feat would be jumping up and down and taking a selfie. My buddy, without a bow, tail wag, or paw pump, kept right on going. 2 more treetops and we reached an oak in which an uprooted basswood was wedged. He used this to make his way back to terra firma. I was back down now too, and with a flick of his tail as if to say goodbye, he exited stage right. After watching so many animals, I know fun and play are important to them. I want to believe that other than the practical reason of safe travel, he had gone on this journey for the fun of it. I was glad he had taken me along.
Ron Weber is a writer and forester who lives in Weyerhaeuser. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
Coming up, we'll hear how roads could look different here in Wisconsin when they're designed with wildlife safety in mind. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Around 12% of wild mammal deaths in North America are caused by roadway crashes. That's according to research done last year. In some cases, roads cut off animals from migrating in winter. A form of infrastructure called wildlife crossings can help animals bypass those roads. Currently, only about 1,000 of them exist in the United States. Patricia Kramer is an independent wildlife researcher who's worked with the Department of Transportation and state wildlife agencies. She recently talked to WPR's Lee Rayburn.
Patricia, you've studied each state's data on car accidents involving wildlife. What did you find out specifically about Wisconsin and how it compares with the rest of the country?
Sure. Wisconsin, I looked at 5 years of crash data from your Department of Transportation through 2019, and Wisconsin averages over 20,000 reported crashes with wildlife each year. And that winds up being 16% of all your crashes. That's actually quite large. Most states have the number of recorded crashes with wildlife are well under 10,000. And the average of all the states is about 5% of all their crashes are with wildlife. So you very much have a problem there in Wisconsin.
I think anecdotally, we can all see it as we're driving down the roads at one point or another. But how are U.S. roads affecting animal interactions with the environments around them then, Patricia?
Well, as you see, roads can be pretty lethal because of the traffic on them killing the animals. They also create habitat fragmentation for the animals. We can see how a deer can't get to the other side of the road to access water or food. But there's also smaller animals like salamanders trying to migrate to a pond to lay eggs, or turtles, or black bear. Bear are known to be a bit more skittish of roads than other species of animals, so you may have your black bear restricted to one side or the other. So there's the ability to get to your kitchen, your bedroom, your backyard. For all these animals, if they're in an area with roads, those places are bisected with a bunch of vehicles coming through. So it affects the individual animals that you see, but then over time it can affect the populations, and you can lose those populations of animals.
Patricia Kramer, our guest, wildlife researcher. And Patricia, it was in the mid-90s that I came across wildlife crossings for the first time. It was actually a frog tunnel in Davis, California. And I'm wondering what your research says about their effectiveness.
Oh, well, wildlife crossing structures work. And I will encourage anyone who doubts it or would like to see them in action, if you would go to YouTube and type in the words wildlife crossings. We do research here. Well, actually, I'm all over the country, but I have videos online for Utah wildlife crossings and Montana wildlife crossings. And you can see dozens to hundreds of animals, particularly deer, going through structures. There's also great videos by others showing some of the smaller animals, even down to groundhogs or squirrels going across structures, porcupine, skunks, moose. I even have photos of wolves using structures in Montana. So they very much work. If anyone is a naysayer, it's because they're not informed. But we know they work. There are some animals that are skittish. For instance, pronghorn, bighorn, and elk are the problem children. And you can get a couple of the boys to go through, but to get a herd of all of them with the matriarchs leading, they're very skittish, and we typically have to put in overpasses for them because they don't like to be restricted in their movements. And so what we do in our research with wildlife is we put cameras on the entrances to a lot of these structures and even existing bridges and culverts, and we see who goes through and who's skittish and doesn't want to. And then we compare the results and we tell the engineers, okay, length matters, which means don't make it a long, dark tunnel. Keep it high and wide and open, and you'll get a lot more of the animals. So they very much work for the animals they're designed for.
So the benefits for the animals and the animal population, quite clear. But what does the data say about what we've seen in terms of benefits for humans and our transportation systems?
So I went and added up the cost, the average cost of all the crashes that are reported with wildlife in Wisconsin, and it's over $263 million worth of crashes. So that's property damage, people's injuries, and the value of human lives lost. So if we put wildlife crossings in along with some fences to guide these bigger animals like your white-tailed deer, less people will get in crashes, less people will die, people will save money, maybe your insurance rates would go down. And you might be less fearful going out at dawn and dusk when these animals are out and about. So it winds up being a great win-win situation for everyone.
So, Patricia Kramer, if this is a win-win situation for everyone, why aren't there more of these crossings across the United States?
Well, because Departments of Transportation have evolved just providing transport for goods and services and people. And their mission statements do not say too much about the environment, connectivity for wildlife, you know, ecological reasons for doing things. And so we are asking Departments of Transportation to do something they haven't typically considered, and they have to say, well, there's many things we have to consider. So my mission in life is to change the mindset for them to do things that not only benefit wildlife, but will help the transportation department minimize crashes, so the safety aspect, as I've been saying, but also things like, okay, you need to plan for climate change and the water coming through a place like Wisconsin, the runoff in the spring is going to be in greater pulses, greater volumes. And so you need to be planning not just for culverts for water, but placing bridges that encompass more than the 100-year floodplain. And in turn, that will protect the infrastructure
from being washed away by the flooding that might happen with climate change. And you might have terrestrial pathways along the stream that now the animals can use, and even people that are anglers can walk along underneath the road and don't have to pop up over it because it was just a culvert. So there's many small things you can do. And then when a big project comes along, like, say, four-laning a two-lane highway through a national wildlife refuge or a place where there's a lot of animals, we try to encourage the inclusion of wildlife crossing structures early in the planning. That is so critical, not 5 years down the line, but 15 years down the line, saying, hey, let's put in some bridges for wildlife to get underneath the road. So it's multifaceted, working with the transportation departments to consider this, which would save them money and make your road safer for you.
Patricia Kramer, thank you for sharing your research with us.
Oh, no problem. Thanks for your interest.
That was wildlife researcher Patricia Kramer talking to WPR's Lee Rayburn. They talked about wildlife crossings and how they could help animals in Wisconsin ecosystems. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, if you felt like you were just getting by during the pandemic, you're not alone. Look at the psychology behind what some people call survival mode, how we live with it, and how we can break out of it. And the surprising hit game Wordle is just the latest in a long line of word games, puzzles, and brain teasers to capture the public imagination. We want to hear your favorites and why you like them. You can start the show right now. Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let us know your crossword habit if you've jumped on the Wordle bandwagon and why. Again, let us know on the Ideas Network Facebook page. That and more tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then the pandemic has caused a lot of us to feel lonely. So how can we overcome that? We'll hear from a researcher who says the key may be in how we respond to our own negative thinking. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.